Hello everyone, welcome to Adelaide Writers Week for this session with Melissa Lukashenko. It's so fantastic to see such an enormous audience of readers here. And what a privilege it is to be here today on Kaurna land. I'd love to acknowledge the traditional owners of the land and pay respect to elders past and present. And what a joy that we get to celebrate storytelling here today and Aboriginal storytelling at that. My name is Claire Nichols. I host the book show on Radio National. I know some of you already listen to the show, so thank you so much for that. I get to talk to incredible people like Melissa each and every week. Melissa and I have chatted a bunch of times, but this is the first time we've met face-to-face, which is so great. But do follow the show if you can. This week on the show, Rebecca Kwong of Yellow Face is on the show, Nam Lee's on the show, and Melissa's going to be coming up soon. And you guys are going to be a part of that because we are recording today for the ABC. Yes, you know, we clap loudly, we cheer loudly, we make a big fuss about Melissa. And that way you can all be a part of the show. Melissa, you're going to be signing books after the session?
Yeah.
So Melissa's going to be signing books after the session. You can't go wrong with any of Melissa's novels, so buy them all and get them all signed.
Buy early and buy often.
Yeah. Buy it for everyone you know. And it is a real thrill to be here with Melissa Lukashenko today. Melissa is a Miles Franklin winner for her wonderful novel, Too Much Lip. That book brought us the singular heroine of Kerry Salter, a Bundjalung woman on a stolen Harley full of complicated, fiery love for her family and for her land. And I really think Melissa is the queen when it comes to unforgettable, feisty, modern Aboriginal women like Kerry Salter or the brilliant Jo Breen from Mullumbimby.
Well, I'm a Republican, so I'll take president.
Queen, president, anything. But with her new book, Melissa's taken on a pretty big challenge, I'd say. She's taking us to Eden Glassy. This is Brisbane before it was Brisbane in the mid-19th century when, for a moment, Aboriginal people still just outnumbered the white settlers, but everything was about to change. Can you please make a huge round of applause for Melissa Lukashenko? So, Melissa, this book puts Maganjan or Brisbane onto the page, set in the mid-19th century. I'd love to talk about Brisbane in fiction for a second. Do you remember the first time you encountered Brisbane on the page?
Yeah, I do, actually, Claire. It's great to be here on Kaurna country, and I pay my respects to Kaurna custodians, traditional owners and mob, and to any elders in the audience. I was raised with books in the house. Some of them were in Cyrillic and completely baffling to me since no one sort of bothered to explain what Cyrillic was, let alone teach me to read it. But my mum had grown up extremely poor without access to books or much food or new clothing. And so she was determined that her kids would have the things she missed out on. And one of the ways she did that was take us to the Mount Gravatt Library religiously. And so there was always, me and my younger brother were always going to the library, always devouring books when we weren't outside playing in the bush. And, you know, like a lot of people of my generation and older, it was a very Anglo-centric upbringing, you know, the material that we absorbed and a lot of the ideas that we absorbed were from England still, including, you know, your Enid Blytons and your horse books and the Arthur Mee's Children's Encyclopedia. But the one day I opened up a book, I think I must have been about 11 or 12, and it referred to Acacia Ridge. And if you know Brisbane, you'll know that that's a suburb on the border of Brisbane and Logan. And I couldn't believe it. It was like opening up a book and finding a green tree frog in it. That's the only thing I can describe it as, like wonderful but completely amazing. It's like, oh, my God, that world can be in this world. And it had literally never occurred to me before because I didn't know any writers. Later I read the works of Kath Walker, who drew Newknuckle, but I wasn't familiar with them at the time. And, yeah, so that has never left me, and I can tell it was in Springwood, and I know exactly where I was in the car when it happened.
I mean, that's a big thing too to realise. Oh, people from here can write. Like, you could imagine then a future for yourself where you might be able to put places on a page?
Yeah, I don't even think I made that connection at the time. I have no idea who the author was or where they were from, presumably Queensland now. But it was just, it was like the smashing together of two universes.
What does it mean now to be the person who puts Mullumbimby or Brisbane onto the pages of a book for somebody else to pick up and have that moment with?
Oh, that's a big question. what does it mean? It means a responsibility. It means a certain measure of power. And it means that I have to be really careful to not bugger things up. Mm. I was talking to Auntie Pat O'Connor, who's the senior Aboriginal custodian of Yugambeh country, who gave me permission to write what I wrote about in Eden Glassy. And I was saying to her about, you know, getting the history right, and then I'd talk to Ray Evans, who's a historian from Queensland, a really brave historian. He's retired now. But in the Joe Bjelke-Petersen era, he was writing about genocide and massacres in a time when there was a radical conversation going on, but it was definitely a fairly dangerous thing to be doing in the Joe Bjelke-Petersen era. And I had been talking to Ray, and he said to me, Melissa, it's all fiction. All history is fiction. And that, you know, loosened up some restraints that I'd put on myself. And then I had a conversation with Auntie Pat, and she said, yes, but they'll take it as gospel. Bub, you have to be really careful and get it right. So I was, I can't even remember what the question was.
Yeah, we're talking about, I guess, the power of putting this place on the page. Let's visit the history or...
Stop knocking things over.
Yeah. Have a drink. So let's talk about Eden Glassy. We'll start with the name. Remind us where Eden Glassy comes from.
Yeah, it's supposed to be a blending of Edinburgh and Glasgow, although that's disputed. And there was a fellow called Forbes who was the New South Wales Attorney General in the 1850s. And, of course, there was no such entity as Queensland. It was all New South Wales up the East Coast, if you were talking in European terms. And so he lands in Magungeon, Brisbane, and decides that Eden Glassy is a good name because that's near the part of Scotland that meant a lot to him. And he tried to bestow that name on the town, but it didn't stick. It was at the time Moreton Bay penal settlement, or had just stopped being a penal settlement, maybe. And Brisbane had not been, you know, suggested yet. So for a very brief time, it was Eden Glassy. And because it didn't stick, because it was a proposal that didn't come to pass, that's why I used it for the book, because I wanted to talk about things that didn't happen in this place, things that didn't happen on Yuggera country and which could have happened. Because I think we can be seduced into thinking that there are no alternative futures, as well as that there are no alternative pasts. I can't remember if it was Barbara Kingsolver or somebody else who said that the, might have been Ursula Le Guin, who said that capitalism seems inevitable, but then so did the rule of, the divine rule of kings, you know. When you're living inside something, you can't see beyond it very often. And I wanted to see beyond colonisation that happened in that particular way. And if there's no alternative to coming in and stealing someone's country and wholesale slaughter, then in a way that gives you a free pass, you know. If people can't imagine that there's another way to be, that there's another way to proceed in the world, then you're not inspired to fight for a better way and a better future, are you? Mm. You know, but Palestinians know that there's a better way. You know, there doesn't have to be the mass shooting of people lining up to feed their starving children. It's just that's what we are living inside of at the moment. And so my work is about growing hope and helping us to feel less alone and to remind us all that there's a civilised way to live. You know, the Wiradjuri call it Yindjimara, Yindjimara. In the top end, in Yolnumata from northeast Arnhem Land. I think it's called Madanga, something like that. Probably not quite right. And in my language, Bunjalung, it's called Garama Malala. And garama is stream or story. And story is law. And lala makes it a verb. So it's the way of story, the way of law. And that means civilization. All of those words I just said all mean civilization. And so my work is about hope and humour and garama malala.
So I guess you're saying there that there's a lot of power to be found in storytelling, right? I mean, some people would think that fiction, you know, something you pick up, you read, you put down and nothing changes. But you see your role as more than that. Can you explain, like, what the power of a story or storytelling can be for you in your line of, in what you do?
All of life is stories. All of life is stories. Barry Lopez said, the only things holding us together are stories and compassion. And if we lose either of them, then we lose compassion and we lose being human. And stories come in many forms. You know, the literary novel, since Audible started making audiobooks, and yeah, sit in the shade. If you're in the sun, find some shade and be in the shade. There's no point being uncomfortable. You know, audiobooks and podcasts, you know, all that audio stuff now is making literary fiction more accessible to people. Much more accessible, and it's really, really exciting for me. You know, I'm like everyone. I go up and down in my moods, and there have been times when I've thought I write for not a niche audience, but a fairly small audience. You know, people who are educated, people who can afford to either buy a book or belong to a library in an urban centre, and then I read Demon Copperhead, and it's like, oh my god, of course this is transformational. Of course I need to keep writing. You know, and just those, the great books do for me what I try to do for others.
Wow. Yeah. Let's go back to Eden Glassy in the 1850s. Can you tell us what this place looked like? Because it can be hard to imagine now.
Yes. I did a lot of research for the book, and I had the great luck to have lived in the Kingdom of Tonga in 1997 for 12 months. And I have spent a fair bit of time in the bush in Australia as well and in small country towns. Because at the time, Brisbane was a settlement, or Eden Glassy, or Moreton Bay, was a settlement of 800 to 1,000 white people and roughly the same number of black fellas either living there or passing through. So, you know, a town of 2,000 people on the banks of a river that was not as muddy as it is today. And no paved roads. The first paved roads came in a decade or two or three after the time the book's sent, and they were made not of stone or of bitumen, but of blocks of wood. Imagine that, blocks of wood. It was a dusty place. It was a muddy place. It was full of the sound of bullocks lowing, because bullock wagon was the transport of the day. Dogs barking. The clank of convict chains was no longer heard. That's one of the sentences in the book, because the convict era has just ended where I set the book. I set it in this time of great transformation. The convict era of 25-odd years had come and gone. The place had been colonised with the British and their guns and their soldiers, who are called diamonds in the book. That was the slang. But there was still a really large population of First Nations there, both the traditional owners, the Yuggera people, who lived on the banks of the river. They'd been pushed from the CBD area of Brisbane across to where South Bank is today. And Brisbane GPO actually sits on a women's birthing site where the Yuggera women were always birthed traditionally, or that clan anyway.
Those Aboriginal clans across the Brisbane area, like, how much were they interacting with each other?
Well, this is what I wanted to show. Henry Reynolds, in his book With the White People, talked about how there was a hell of a lot of trade and commerce and labour exchange with Aboriginal people and the colonists. So I wanted to show that, you know, and that's why one of my characters is Nita, who works for the pioneering Petrie family. And Nita is an Aboriginal girl, but she's Christianised. So she has one experience of being a black fella then, and her love interest, her lover, who becomes her husband, Mullinyan, he's a tribal man who's not a Christian. He's been through his tribal ceremonies, and their love story is the engine of the historic part of the novel.
I hope you'll forgive me for talking for just a minute here, but sure. I read Eden Glassie about a week before I went to Brisbane for the first time in my life.
Oh, wow.
And I had a really kind of wonderful experience walking on the South Bank because I recognised it from your book, and I recognised where Granny Edie falls down on the South Bank, but I also could see Mullinyan going on his canoe across the river, and I could almost see these two versions of the place at once.
That's great. I mean,
can you see that when you walk through Brisbane? Can you see?
All Aboriginal people live in dual time. You know, if you're a cultural Aboriginal person, and I'm sure this is true for historians and it might be true for geographers or some other people, but absolutely, if you're First Nations, when you walk, you're walking in the footsteps of your ancestors if you're on country. And so you're constantly harking back and thinking about what they saw, what they smelled, what they experienced. And if you've got the knowledge, you'll be thinking about the song lines as well and the lore stories embedded in that country. But that's great that you could recognise the story in the landscape.
Oh, I mean, you just did such a great job, I guess, of painting the place.
Yeah, well, it's important to me. You know, we've got responsibilities as Indigenous people to understand where we live. You know, it is a constant source of amazement to me that some white people, not all, but some white people have very little understanding of the places that they're born or that they live. I had a bit of land outside of Brisbane at one stage years ago, and I was talking to one of the local white people when I'd first moved up there, and I said, and there was a big mountain at the end of her road, and I said, oh, what's the name of that mountain? And she just looked at me and she didn't know. That's an extreme example, but that's what I'm talking about. To be a fully human person, to be a fully human black fella, you must know your country intimately. Otherwise, you're just kidding yourself and you're losing out on so much. But I think people are coming to that sort of understanding very slowly.
The historical storyline in Eden Glassie is set a generation after first contact.
Yep.
I know you didn't want to write a first contact story. Mm. Can you explain why you didn't want to write that particular story?
It's a combination of not wanting to and not feeling capable. You know, there's this very tiresome conversation where people come up to me and say, can I write an Aboriginal story? And it's like, well, no, and it's not me saying it, it's just reality that you can't because you don't have the capacity. To write a first contact story, I'd have to know a lot more about Yagara people and how they lived before colonisation. And because I'm not Yagara, I haven't grown up in that particular mob. I don't have their particular stories, their particular understanding of country. I've got a pretty good grasp, good enough to satisfy the custodians with whose permission I wrote this story. But I also thought it was culturally useful to me to write it at a point where the numbers were about equal, you know, because dominance over other people is anathema in my understanding of Aboriginal culture. You know, to oppress another people is the opposite of Yindjamara, of Garmalmalalala. It's the wrong way to go about things. It's not civilised. And so to set the book at a time when the white and Indigenous populations were approximately equal is a kind of a underpinning of that idea.
And an incredibly tense setting for the story as well. How long were you thinking about this book before you started writing it, Melissa?
Probably since the early 90s.
Wow.
Yeah. I read the Reminiscences of Tom Petrie, which was written by his daughter, Constance Petrie. And Tom is a character in the book, and he was a white man of Scottish parents who came to Brisbane as a young child. And there weren't a lot of other white kids around. He had his siblings and a few other white kids, but he ran off and grew up with the black fellas pretty much. He was always in the blacks' village. He spoke fluent Yagara. He was initiated when the time came for him to be initiated. And at 12 years old, he would take the colonists out far from Brisbane because they knew that he could, it was of a diplomatic status that he could safely carry them through Aboriginal country, if they weren't doing anything wrong anyway. So, Tom, sorry, what was the question?
The question was how long you were thinking about it. So you read this book in the 90s.
The Reminiscences of Tom Petrie, and there was just so much in that book that's wasn't known then and still isn't known now. You know, things like the hanging of Dundalee, the resistance leader, in the middle of town, in the main street of Brisbane, and the way it was botched by the hangman of the day. You know, that's a central scene in the book. That, in fact, that is probably the central scene of the book, because I set it in 1855 and everything else is folded in around 1855. I've changed the dates when some things happened so that I could have Dundalee being hung in the manner he was and at the time he was, in the place he was, accurate, because that was really important. That was the time when the main powerful resistance figure was brought down by the colonial establishment. And resistance hasn't ever ended and sovereignty hasn't ever been ceded formally, but that was a turning point in race relations in Yagara country.
When did you know you were finally ready to start telling this story?
When I had a conversation with the senior traditional owner and she agreed that I could go ahead. I asked her at first and she sort of said, oh, yeah, go away and write about your own mob. And I was like, okay, well, this is a big project. If I want to do it, I'll have another crack. And normally I wouldn't do that. Normally I'd just go away humbly and accept that. And I went back to her and I said, look, this is why I want to write the book. This is what I want to show in the book. And the second time she said, all right, let's have a conversation. And she ended up giving me, like, just in maybe 3 or 4 conversations of an hour each, so much information. And it really underpinned why I didn't have the capacity to write a first contact story. Mm. You know, I learnt so much in those brief conversations. It's that really was a humbling experience.
For the actual writing of Eden Glassie, my understanding is you didn't really have a writing room. You were kind of living in different houses.
For
what were you doing?
Now, for the bulk of it, I had a room. I have a study wherever I'm living. But at the time of the Queensland floods, it's had an interesting gestation, this book. I did the research in 2009, or the formal library-based research of the archives and Trove and stuff, 2019. Then we had the bushfires. Going into 2020, I started the actual writing, and, of course, the pandemic came along. So 2020, 2021, I just wrote through the pandemic. Excuse me. And then in early 2022, Brisbane and northern New South Wales had the massive flood. So I was coming to the end of writing the book as my daughter was being taken out of a house by the SES and everywhere was just going underwater. And I became briefly homeless. So it's, you know, flood, fire and pestilence, this book.
Oh, my goodness. So, yeah, your daughter moved into your place and you
She was traumatised. She almost died.
Oh, my goodness.
Yeah. Should I read that bit from the beginning?
Yeah,
give people
absolutely.
A taste? Yeah.
Melissa is going to read just a section from the first part of Eden Glassie, which is set in 2024.
Just to give you a sense of the voice. I'm a bit dry. I don't know why. So chapter one, The Fall, 2024. Eddie Blanket was falling towards the good Yagara earth. A calamity. At her great age, a fall meant the end, simple as that. Broken hip, pneumonia, kaput. Even as she lost the vertical, though, Granny Eddie was rejecting the whole stupid idea. He didn't live to her age by damn well accepting things, so she was definitely not falling. Toppling, well, yes, possibly. Or teetering, oh, like the teeter-totter in the schoolyard, remember? Hot yellow sunshine in the playground, thumping up and down with Lizzie Norman on the other end, Lizzie's terrible buck teeth bared in joy. Lizzie was dead and buried now, of course. Nearly everyone was. Eddie had buried her own kids and her husband too. She'd outlived the lot. And now here she was at Southbank, poised on the edge of the precipice herself. She observed with a kind of detached dismay her right knee buckling to the footpath outside the Maritime Museum. her walking stick betraying her to skid across the grass and into the nearest garden bed. There was a solid 3 inches of cement between Granny Eddie's person and the good Yagara dirt of the ancestors, but that was of no concern to gravity, or indeed to Granny Eddie, for she was knocked cold by the fall. Everything had buggered up, gone skew-if. Blurred trees grew out of wavering buildings. Human-shaped blobs stood at a right angle to normality. And something else was off too. The traffic on Vulture Street had frozen in its lane. The city cat didn't move in midstream. Even the Qantas jet roaring over the river had decided to pull up and have a jolly old breather. Granny Eddie blinked in confusion. Then her brain slowly began to crochet together a looped understanding of events. Her stupid fall outside the museum, that was right. She'd tripped on the tiniest jutting tree root, and in outrage the earth had flung itself up at her, insisting she join it. This act of remembering made time begin thumping sharply in her left temple. Ouch, ouch, ouch. Eddie Blanket lay there, registering her injuries for 2 minutes and 27 seconds. An elder, mind you, laid low in the middle of the path. Terrible, terrible, and the white fellas walking well out of their way to avoid her, to avoid even looking at her. There they go. Bugger you, Jack. I'm all right. That's your motto, eh? Christ almighty, drunk. Can't you see I'm hurt and someone needs to stop and help an old black woman? And instead you go and turn your nose up at me as a drunk on metho. Good go. Bugger off then, useless. And you, I can just about see your mutt, missy. Didn't the shop have a skirt your size to make you go and buy a child's one? No shame at all. And in a sudden burst of rage, who dragged you's mob up? A person could be dead for all you care. You, I'm talking to you. This is my country too. Don't I count? When all of a sudden some youngsters stopped, kneeled down and murmured in concern, a flooding relief of tears because everything hurt and somebody cared.
Give me that back. Melissa Lukashenko reading from Eden Glassy. I'm so glad you read that, Melissa, because you've got such a distinctive voice. It's fierce and funny and it's rude and it's real. And this has been there throughout your career. Like, when you first started writing in this way, did you feel like you were doing something different than people had done before?
No, see, I had no idea. I had read Kerry Hume, and I grew up on Banjo Paterson and Henry Lawson and Ruth Park, and I had read Peter Carey and some other writers, but the world of publishing was just complete mystery to me. I had no idea.
Do you think your confidence in that voice has grown as your career's gone on? I'm thinking of a character like Winona, Eddie's granddaughter, who, I mean, she's so fierce, even by your standards, I would say. Like, could you have written her at the start of your career, do you reckon?
I think I was her at the start of my career.
Seeing the world in black and white.
Well, I'm the only person in my family to have gone to university, and I sometimes feel like, you know, it was a blessing to get that education, but I lost something through it as well, because I think it was Tom Sawyer who said, you know, they're going to civilise me and I can't stand it. When I wrote Kerry Salter in Too Much Lip, I was trying to write a character as if, as similar to myself, but if I hadn't gone to university, if I'd gone to jail instead of university. The craft, you know, craft becomes refined over the years, and I can write better now than I could in 1997 when I put my first book out. And I know what I'm doing with my characters. I'm much more strategic, of course. That's what develops over the decades of hard work. It's fun. Winona was just pure joy to write, because you know you take the brakes off and you get to write someone that wants to burn down Parliament House and you know fuck them all, fuck the system, and then you've got other people who are the voice of reason, and they have that. Not that burning Parliament House down is necessarily a bad idea, but that way you get to have the debates that you want the book to be talking about.
At Adelaide Writers Week, I'm speaking to the Miles Franklin winning author, Melissa Lukashenko. Her latest novel is Eden Glassy, and it takes the reader to Brisbane in the 1850s and also today. I want to go back to the 1850s, Melissa, and meet Mullinyan. Who is Mullinyan?
Oh, well, he's tall, dark and handsome, of course, being Bundjalung. he's a youth who's on the cusp of manhood. And I've only just realised saying that, that probably subconsciously I made him that age because I wanted a character who was about to burst into his full power as a black man. You know, starts as a black youth who's looking forward to his initiation, and he's just being tested in subtle ways, and before his parents decide it's time for him to go for his manhood ceremony. And so that gives the book a certain propulsion that as his society is coming under greater and greater attack, as things are crumbling and the war is looking different, that he himself is becoming stronger, physically stronger, morally stronger, intellectually stronger. So I like playing with not duopolies, that's economics, dualities.
How does he end up in South Brisbane?
Yeah, well, in reality, a fella from the Gold Coast, which is where he's from, Yugambeh country, would have been taken to northern New South Wales to Corakai, a little tiny town called Corakai that just almost got destroyed in the floods for his ceremony. But in the book I just said Corakai is not happening for a while. It's important that he goes for his initiation because the white girls are starting to look at him, and that's very, very dangerous. His mother's horrified when she realises that white girls are taking an interest in her son because that could, you know, be his undoing and everyone's undoing in that era, or indeed in this era. And so he gets taken up to Brisbane by his father, up to Magunjan, to be put through the law of the neighbours, the Yuggera people. And the father has to race back home, and Mullinyan gets put into the care of the Yuggera people. And so he develops a dual allegiance both to Bundjalung and to Brisbane, which is something that I also have.
I had a nice moment reading back through Mullumbimby and coming across the word Mullinyan.
Yeah.
Yeah, what does it mean?
Mullinyan is one word for the white-faced heron, which is my personal totem.
Oh, how lovely. Mm. So we've got Mullinyan in South Brisbane. He ends up doing some work for the Petrie family, who we've spoken about already. Mm. The Petrie family is generally pretty respectful of Aboriginal people, comparatively. But, you know, most people aren't. How dangerous is it for Mullinyan to be a black man in this world?
Well, it's a time of shifting allegiances. It's a time when colonisation has occurred. So the military control of the area is in white hands, but only in the very central area of Brisbane. You know, if you look through the historic records, there's people talking about being terrified to go a couple of miles or 5 miles outside of the what's now the Brisbane CBD for fear of Aboriginal attack. And I was actually in Kyogle the other day, which is a town near Lismore, and I was talking to an old, well, she wasn't even old, she was like 70, white lady who was a retired nurse, and I said, have you been in Kyogle all your life? And she said, oh, no, I came over from South Lismore. When I first came to Kyogle, she's talking about the 1970s, she said, oh, I hadn't seen an Aboriginal. I thought they were going to spear me.
Oh, my goodness.
Which, you know, she was joking, but not entirely joking. And so this era of fear of the blacks and Aboriginal people being justifiably fearful of the rifles of the whites, you know, it casts a long shadow.
Mm. Hmm. I know the inspiration for the character of Mullinyan came in part from a real person whose name was Kipper Billy.
Mm.
I don't want to talk too much about what happened to Kipper Billy because I don't want to spoil the story. But the records of Kipper Billy, they say we don't know where he was from, we don't know who his family was.
Mm.
Was there power for you in Mullinyan's story, giving him land, giving him family and giving him that, I guess, that kind of grounding as a person?
That was the only way to write it. There's every Aboriginal person at that historic moment would have known where they were from. You know, it might have been very rare exceptions, but colonisation operates by taking land and by breaking the familial bonds, you know, and those familial bonds are still being broken today. You know, Aboriginal children are still being taken from Aboriginal families where there are members of those families who will happily take those kids and raise them safely. It happens all the time, you know. It'll happen tomorrow. It would have happened yesterday all over Australia. I've got family members being raised by white people because the family wasn't able to hang on to those kids. And it's a very, very great evil to have your children taken from your culture as well as from your family. And the end of that sentence has been stolen by menopause.
Great appreciation for that. Yeah, I guess this is what's so important in the storytelling, right, Melissa, because when people are removed from their families, from their land, those connections are lost, those ancestral connections are lost, that culture is lost. It's important.
It's damaged.
Yeah.
It's not always lost. It can be regained and replaced. It's not a you're Aboriginal on your country or you're just some pathetic remnant of it. There's a whole spectrum of ways of being and ways of knowing country and knowing who you are on country. The colonial project is about land and money. And so to take Mullanyin off his country, that happens organically almost. It doesn't actually happen through white interference. His father goes back to where his mother's sick, and so he's just left with the Yuggera mob. That's all done between Aboriginal people in an Aboriginal way, and that's fine. Nita has a different story. Nita had to be rescued, and the things she had to be rescued from form part of the narrative of the book, which you'll get when you buy a copy for yourself and a couple of copies for all your family.
Now, I'd love to talk a bit about Nita because you've mentioned a bit about her. She's the love interest. Mm. She's been Christianised.
Yep.
She's working for the Petries. Who was the inspiration for this character?
Well, she's called Nita because I went to Anita Heiss's 50th birthday party and, as usual, I was running late and didn't have a birthday present, so I had to stand up and say, I don't have a present for you, Anita, but I'll name a character after you in my next book. But she's Anita was also partly drawn on the life of my great-grandmother, who grew up off-country, to the best of our knowledge, and who was effectively a slave for a white family from the age of 8. We believe she was with Aboriginal people until the age of 8. Whether they were her family or whether she was a survivor of a massacre, we don't know. We have very scant knowledge of her. But she was a servant from 8 years old, or an unpaid servant from 8 years old, doing the laundry for a white family in Gympie in Queensland. Very smart woman, a woman who made a life in a colonial setting, and a woman who managed to hang on to most of her kids and grandkids. Not all of them. She lost one grandchild that she wanted and couldn't keep, but most of her family remained intact enough that we know each other as a family.
Is this the same great-grandmother that you reference in the the start of Too Much Lip?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Wow. Yeah, she's the... Yeah, she was arrested because she shot a man who tried to rape her, a black man. And if she'd shot a white man, I don't know what would have happened, but she shot a black man who tried to rape her, and it went to court, and she actually got off the charge, and he was sent to prison for 6 months instead. So, and again, you know, she knew how to work the system and survive and stay alive through the Depression when the family almost starved. Here we are today.
What an incredible woman.
She was. She was.
I think one of the challenges in this novel is that for the historic part of the story, you can't fall back on that voice that we know and love you for, that very contemporary voice that you have for your modern characters. Mm. Where did you have to go to find the voice of Nita and Mullanyin?
Yeah, I don't know that I've ever thought about it explicitly, Claire, but there's a lot that remains of Aboriginal life and culture and language and voice that hasn't changed all that much, I think, from early times. And, you know, for example, Granny Eddy, to go in the other direction, a lot of my mum in Granny Eddy, and also a lot of an old lady called Auntie Hilda Muir, who was from Borroloola, who I helped write a memoir years ago. And she'd grown up as a yellow fella, a mixed-race child in Borroloola, and was taken away in 1928 on a train to Darwin and put into the Darwin half-caste's home, and couldn't speak English when she got there, had no idea whatsoever of white culture. And she, speaking of amazing lives, she had an incredible life, but I think her voice and the voice of some Bundjalung elder women all went into Granny Eddy. So I think all the characters have conglomerate voices. Mm-hmm. But what I did with Mullinyan and Nita, you know, I looked at Trove, I looked at historic literature, a lot of historic novels. There's a lot more novels of early Queensland than I realised, and early East Coast Australia. So I read some of them, you know, the Ultima Thule books and a lot of books. A book called The Land Takers by Brian Penton. And Penton was a editor and a journalist, a writer who spoke to probably to someone like Durham Boy, James Davis, who was a former convict who went off and lived in Wide Bay with the Aboriginal tribes for 17 years, I think it was. And he came back, Davis. He was, I think he had a shoe shop in the Brisbane CBD when he came back, and he would never talk to anyone. He would never say anything about when he'd lived out with the blacks. And he said, if people want to know about living with the blacks, let them go out and live with them themselves, because I'm not going to talk about it. And he had obviously been initiated, gone, he'd completely assimilated into Aboriginal culture before he came back, and probably left children behind and grandchildren behind too. There's a Davis line in those areas today. And, yep.
Mullinyan and Nita have this big, epic, romantic love story.
They had to.
Last time I spoke to you, I think I said, are you a romantic? And you laughed at me, which was fair, and you told me it was a silly question. and then I read a review that actually said that your work's, like, actually quite horny, and I thought maybe I should have asked how horny your work was. I mean, how important is it for you to write about desire and connection? Because this is a big theme in all of your books.
Well, I've got to sell books, Claire. I was getting ready to go, how dare you? Look, you know, Aboriginal people are human. You know, we might suffer, but we laugh and we fight and we fuck and we do all the things that everybody on the planet does, and that has to be shown on the page.
And the people... The men are just gorgeous specimens, all of them. Two boy, you know. Oh, she's dropped her microphone.
They're Bundjalung. Yeah. what can I say? I don't make the rules.
you have talked before. You know, you kind of flippantly say, "I've got to sell books," but you have spoken about this, that, you know, you catch more flies with honey than with vinegar. You know, how much is this forefront in your mind when you're sitting down to write, and you want people to confront Brisbane's history, but you also want people to read and love the book?
I want people to be moved. I want people to have an emotional experience, and I don't want to add to the misery of the world. So I need to make beautiful characters who have power and humour and love and land, and I want to put them in conflict with either events or other people. That's what I do. You know, if I was trying to be entirely political, I would probably do something like bush poetry or, I don't know, become a singer-songwriter or something. I know three chords. I could probably learn three more and write songs and, you know, do that kind of thing. But I am someone who loves literature, who loves narrative, you know, and I get such pleasure and... You know, it's the life force pours into me when I read great writing, and that's what I want to help other people experience. I'll just go back to language because I forgot, being menopausal. The when I was creating the voices for Mullinyan and Nita, particularly for Mullinyan and his offsider Murray, who's his best mate and his law brother, what I had to do was write them in almost standard English of the day, because I knew if I wrote them in a Creole tongue, a kind of a pidgin English mixture of Yorgambeh in English or any kind of modified English, that they would be read as less intelligent. Mm. That's just an unfortunate fact. I've even had an editor in the past when I have had a Aboriginal character say with, like W-I-F instead of with, say that that made him sound stupid, and that's just like an Aboriginal accent. Mm. So I knew that they had to speak in relatively standard English in order for the character to work and in order for the book to be readable enough, because it's really important to me that people don't have to struggle too much to read my books. Mm. If I think it's a conceit and a arrogance to write books that aren't accessible to most of the population.
Yeah. And we love you for it, Melissa. You said you'd been percolating on this story for over a decade. Was the contemporary storyline, the 2024 storyline, always going to be there in this book? So when did that arrive?
I started actual research 2019, so probably about 5 or 6 years ago when I started actually turning my attention to this book, and I thought, ironically, the trope of the dying Aboriginal race seems to be almost unkillable. I write a book like Too Much Lip, or no, Mullumbimby, and some idiot reviewer talks about Jo finding her culture. You know, the stupid idea that all Aboriginal people are damaged beings with no culture, or else just literally dead. So I knew that if I only wrote the historic story and, you know, it contains damage to individuals and the culture generally, that would be picked up and seized upon, whether consciously or not, by a lot of readers and a lot of critics and a lot of people with malign intent too, probably. So I had to have this living, vibrant, extremely funny, I'm told, characters in the present day, in Brisbane, in the place where Mullinyan and Nita come face to face with colonial violence, in order to say we're still here, we're not going anywhere, we have to live together because we are not leaving. And the colony, you know, the colony that we live among all of us, by which I mean the structures of white supremacy and British imperialism as was, that is what has to change because we're not going.
Hmm. You read that great opening scene of Granny Eddy. Let's talk about Granny Eddy for a few minutes because she's the best. Yeah. who is she and how much is she like your mum?
She's a lot more like my mum than I intended, although my mum went to a lot of effort to hide her Aboriginality for most of her life. Until probably the last decade of her life, she kept pretty quiet except among the family, and there was a few Aboriginal families locally that knew that we were black. I mean, my oldest brother looks very black. He can't hide it, but those of us who are fair were encouraged to assimilate and survive that way. So Granny Eddy's proudly Aboriginal, and she's dark enough that she couldn't assimilate if she wanted to. Couldn't hide if she wanted to was a better way of putting that. But apart from that, the attitude, the words, you know, the that kind of, buggy you, Jack, I'm all right. I can just hear my mum saying that. That's exactly... And she talked about mobs of people as crowds. And when I went back into Trove and the old materials, that descriptor of a group of people as a crowd, you know, oh, that crowd over on the hill, you know, that crowd in town, that's just these little slight differences was really fun to tweak the language and evoke the era.
And she's so oppositional, isn't she?
Yeah. I should say she's also based a bit on a Bundjalung elder who's passed now, who I helped also with a private memoir. And had spent a lot of time with in the year immediately before I wrote the book, from the Williams family. But, oppositional. She's what's called a polarity responder. Does anyone know what a polarity responder is?
I don't.
Oh, brilliant, brilliant. It's the best thing. Look it up. Look it up. she's contrary. Mum always said to me, you're contrary. That's what you are. You're contrary. And that's what Granny Eddie is. So that that allowed me to play with history a lot, because whenever any historical argument was put to her, she would, you know, normally flip to the other side, because that's what she likes to do. She likes to be contrary.
I was speaking to another Aboriginal writer, Melanie Sayward, recently, and she was talking about how much you've inspired her work and this credo you have of beauty, power, humour, land as being central to what you give your characters.
Yeah.
I wondered what it's like for you to know that this next generation of writers are looking to you as an idol, as a guide.
Well, I had great teachers, so I feel quite confident about that. You know, I'm drawing on people like Auntie Barb Cummings from Darwin and Uncle Les Collins from Cherbourg, and a whole host of Aboriginal teachers, Alexis Ride, who I know was here earlier in the week. A lot of people, and we're all carrying the same thread. You know, we are all carrying the same sensibility through from probably from thousands of years ago. You know, if we're trying to write within the context of Aboriginal law, we're not necessarily telling the same stories, but we are speaking in the same voice that has been voiced here for a very, very, very long time, if we know what we're doing.
I think it's going to be a really good year for First Nations fiction this year. Like, you know, we're only in March. I've read two incredible books from your patch of Australia. So we've got Charlene Allsop writing The Great Undoing. She's a Bundjalung writer. We've got Michaela Saunders, a Guri writer, writing Always Will Be, which is a fantastic collection of new fiction. Does it feel like there is a bit of a surge in terms of First Nations fiction at the moment?
Yeah, absolutely. And there's structural reasons for that. And, you know, we're now into the second and third generations of Aboriginal people who are fully literate in English and going to university and have some kind of access to the lifestyle that you need to write a novel. But, yeah, Michaela's voice is really interesting, I think. Michaela Saunders, I see a lot of my own ethos reflected in what Michaela does to a really surprising degree sometimes.
And there's power, right, in the more stories there are, the more stories there are about this part of the world, the more Bundjalung stories, the more Guri stories.
So long as they're from people who are culturally knowledgeable, and Michaela is. We have to be careful of people who are new to their Aboriginality standing up and telling the same story that is really palatable, which is one of, I've lost my culture, I'm coming back to being Aboriginal and I'm new, and that's a much more damaging story than might be obvious from the outside, because it places us as diminished when there's plenty of us who know where we're standing, who know what we're on about, and who have a great deal to teach Australia and the world. Mm. And while I'm on the topic of teaching Australia and the world, I just wanted to mention that, as you can see by my wearing of the kefir, that I have deep concerns about what's happening in Gaza at the moment. My daughter-in-law has family members who are at grave risk of being killed and who are very, very hungry right now. And I also wanted to mention that the Adelaide Festival, not the Writers' Festival, but the Adelaide Festival, contains on its board Amanda Vanstone, who is also a board member of Lockheed Martin Australia. And the fighter jets that are currently bombing Gaza are manufactured by Lockheed Martin. And so I think it's a great concern as a taxpayer and as a citizen of the world that there is such a strong connection between Lockheed Martin, the merchants of death, and the Adelaide Festival. And I would ask you all to reflect on that.
Thank you.
Are we really that hard up as a country?
I want to make a bit of an awkward pivot here, because I do want to celebrate something before we leave the stage. Melissa, yesterday here at Adelaide Writers Week, the Stella Prize long list was announced. And Melissa Lukashenko is one of our long-listed writers for Eden Glassy. And
third time lucky.
You had the biggest grin on your face when that got announced. How important is it for you to get this sort of recognition?
It's important and it's gratifying, and the money is really important if, you know, if things come to money. But the best feedback is from, you know, Aboriginal women and girls and elders, you know, people that tell me that my work has given them a voice that they'd never experienced having before in quite this way.
This has been such a joy and an honour. Melissa Lukashenko's books include Mullumbimby, Too Much Lip and her latest, Eden Glassy. Make sure you read them all. Too Much Lip is actually the book I still, if someone says to me, I'm stuck and I don't know what to read, I give them Too Much Lip and they come back and say, I loved it. Thank you so much. My name is Claire Nichols. This conversation will play on the book show soon, so make sure you're following the show on the podcast or ABC Listen app. And for now, can you please thank the wonderful Melissa Lukashenko?
Free Palestine. Free Palestine.